before we open this up, in terms of the like black and white letters of Torah, as it were, I just wanted to ask you to think of a particularly strong food memory. You may have many, but particularly if there's like something that you find you might spend like an inordinate amount of time or emotional energy on food-wise that doesn't like quite feel rational. And just like conjure that up if you can. And then we'll try to probe a little bit of like what is at stake in food, and particularly like food and Torah and God. Yes.
When I was at camp, they like said to us, like the three oldest, they know, they were like, you know, we're going to do like a, not a field trip, but like a little venture to Shechita, and we're going to like, you know, watch a chicken get, you know, prepared for killing and then killed. And then if you want, you can help, you know, pluck it afterwards. So yeah, that was, you know, it was a good experience. I mean, it was a meaningful, enlightening experience.
I think I spend a lot of energy thinking about how to get like peanut butter off of a knife, like after you've spread it on something. Which like, yeah, it feels like important to me. Like I eat a lot of peanut butter.
Right.
That's like the food I eat the most of, and like always I've never had a great like, you know, like shita, a great like way of going about making sure that there's not residue left on the knife.
This is hydrogenated or unhydrogenated?
100% yes.
Okay, and even so. Okay, so just like that mental energy and attention that's going into like, what do I do with this peanut butter shell on the knife? Okay, thank you.
I'm Dahlia. I was just thinking about chicken soup and how it makes me nostalgic.
Amazing. Yeah, so I grew up in Baltimore, in kind of two different parts of Baltimore at least. And this connects to chicken soup, so I'm sharing it. And my dad lived in a part of Baltimore that was like really not particularly Jewish. We were basically the only, what I growing up knew of, I had friends who described themselves as half Jewish. That was their own terminology. But I was sort of the only one who had two Jewish parents. So that was sort of one neighborhood. And then my mom was in the sort of Orthodox part of Baltimore. And I remember growing up at one point, I was like, I know what makes Orthodox Jews Orthodox. It's chicken soup on Friday night, and it's walking in the streets on Shabbos. Because on Shabbos, we just sort of like take over those streets. It's very interesting. Anyway, yes, the chicken soup can be very formative. Okay, there's so many. And we know like from contemporary neuroscience, like the brain with the sort of part of the brain, then food and sense, of smell and memory are very all closely tied together. So there are sort of scientific reasons for why we might have strong memories with food. But I think there's also just like, there's so much happening in a food encounter. I had a thought recently, I'm very makpid, very careful about making a birthday cake from scratch for all of my children. Because my father was very careful about this. There's all the energy that went into the birthday cake. And I had a thought recently, I was sort of spending all this time on the birthday cake for one of my children this year. And I was like, is it really worth the time? Will they really care at the end of the day? Like if it's the same sweetness factor, has the same amount of chocolate, does it really matter if like I'm staying up late to make the cake myself? And I had this thought that like, this is sort of korban. It's like investing all of this kind of time and energy in a way that's like, is it necessary? It's not really necessary, but it's sort of like channeling all sorts of emotions into this birthday cake. And I do think it would be maybe like bringing a korban shlamim, right? The kind of sacrifice that was brought in the Mishkan to kind of mark even a joyous occasion, and you get to eat some of that and you share it with others. But also there's like gratitude can be mixed with anxiety around moments like this where we're so grateful for what we have, but also realize how fragile it is. And I sort of realized like all of that was going into the birthday cake for these children. So I sort of share all of this as a way to open up our time of learning and sort of not underestimating what is happening in an encounter with food. Now, in some ways, this isn't fair because like we have to encounter food all the time to live, and to be like that intentional about it all the time is maybe kind of impossible or overwhelming. But I do want to suggest that kind of the way that our Jewish practice and halacha like structures encounter with food, there's a lot there And I kind of want to stretch our imaginative capacity this evening as an invitation for the rest of the week to tease out like what all of that might be. So specifically, we're going to look at the idea of saying brachot before and after eating food, and also saying brachot before and after Torah. Like when somebody comes up for an aliyah, they say a bracha before that aliyah, they say a bracha after. And by virtue of that comparison, what I really want us to get at is the ways in which an encounter with food can really be an encounter with God, and kind of why that might matter. Okay, and we're just going to try to understand one verse from Sefer Tehillim, Psalms. I feel like Tehillim is sometimes like underrated. We're like used to having these verses of Psalms kind of thrown throughout the Siddur in a sort of hodgepodge. And I think sometimes people who have a very devotional practice of reciting Tehillim all the time, I remember being on a bus in Israel and you know, you see mostly women, not exclusively, like reciting Tehillim constantly. And I know I would have these sort of knee-jerk reactions of like, are you shutting out the world? Are you like not engaged? Like, why aren't you reading the news sometimes? Like all these judgmental thoughts going through my head. But it's like amazing, just the level of emotional roller coasterness that is housed in Tehillim. Very powerful. So this is one verse, and in many ways, like it's really one phrase we're going to focus on. I just kind of want to understand three words in this pasuk better. That is our goal for the next hour. We're going to like look at a whole bunch of sources to try to get there. But that's really what we're trying to do, is to understand these three words. So maybe someone can give us a reading of this first box on your source sheet here, the pasuk from Tehillim, and that will set us on our way.
Nasot ratzoncha Elokai hapatzati betoratecha betoch mei.
Yeah, betoch mei, indeed. That's the part we're going to focus on. Okay, I delight to do your will, my God. Delight might not even be strong enough. Hafatzti, I like really desire to do your will. Your teaching is in my innards. Just so we all know, the tenses, the verb tenses in the book of Tehillim are like not anything you should feel particularly clear about or committed to. So whether this is in the present or the future, right, the first part seems to be, you know, longing for something. I delight to do your will, or I have delighted, I will delight. Your Torah is in my innards, or maybe I want it to be in my innards. Like, I think we can be somewhat agnostic about whether this has already happened or is a quest. But just talk to me a little bit. What do you think those three words might mean? V'toratcha betoch mayai. Whether you take that as descriptive or aspirational, what might these words mean, your teaching?
And over the past like year and a half, I've been like becoming more observant in my Jewish practices. And often it's like not because I like learned about a new mitzvah and I'm like, okay, well, it's a mitzvah, so I have to do it. It's more like the more I learn about things, the more I have these like internal like gut motivations to do them. Like it wasn't until like when I learned more, I grew up like keeping kosher, but I like learned more about the kashrut laws and learned that like I'd been doing some things that like maybe like weren't the most kosher in like the way I grew up. And it's not that I was like, oh, guess I ought to start keeping kosher differently. It's like I suddenly was just like not tempted to eat food that I otherwise would have been before learning that. And it was like a gut reaction of like, oh, I don't want to eat that. That's not appealing to me. And that's what this made me think of, that it's like an internal thing that like moves you to do mitzvot, as opposed to like it being something that you do because your brain says you should.
Thank you. Gut reaction. That's a nice way of thinking about this. Great. Other thoughts? V'toratcha betoch me'ai. Yes.
I think when I read this phrase, there were like two interpretations that came to mind. One that sounds kind of similar to what you were describing, of just like that God's teachings are like the very like essence of your being. Like it's inside of you. It's not something that you're choosing to do, but it's like the very essence of who you are. And I'm thinking about it in the context of food, like your teaching is in my innards, like the food that you're eating and the things that you're consuming are also like God's teachings. Hmm.
Thank you. Okay. Yes.
So at Eleanor, I guess to add to the list of possible interpretations or possible readings, I thought of like the teaching is occurring in your innards, like the digestion process rather than like the delivered items into your innards.
Yeah, very interesting. Meaning like it's not the throat. Yeah, it's like where digestion happens that we're getting this language. And what does that mean to you?
That the teaching is not like something that just is in your innards, but that the process of teaching is occurring in your innards. Like the process of digestion, that's the process of teaching.
Hmm. Okay. Thank you. It makes me think of Michal's Dvar Torah a little bit and the like the things that maybe need processing. This is just processing to produce the pasta, but like processing the Torah that has entered and is sitting inside you.
Like your teachings are not something that are like out there that I need to go and like quest after, but like they're like a part of me. They're in my essence, and it's sort of something that's like more in your heart. It kind of sounds like I mean the immediately prior pasuk is you know you don't ask us to give burnt offerings and sin offerings, right? Meaning like you don't want us to do all this stuff just for like doing stuff's sake, but rather that it's more it ought to be more of an internal thing that the teachings are in you. They're not something that are out there just per se.
Yeah. It's so interesting, even when you say that in your paraphrase, and you're like, no, it's supposed to be in your heart. I feel like in your heart is something that we are like used to thinking about and all that means to us, like it's emotionally resonant or something like that. It's inside, it's where we what we think with. And betoch me'ar, in some ways what I'm most interested in this verse is the like, why the guts, like why the innards as that place? So I agree with you totally with that. If that perek of Tehillim is like, God doesn't care about what we do externally so much, it's what's inside us, but still, what are these innards about? This is sort of a confusing and therefore provocative and inviting pasuk for later rabbinic interpreters. So I brought you a sort of early midrash that does something with this pasuk and a later midrash. So we have a psikta d'Rav Kahana, one of our earlier midrashim, that brings this pasuk ultimately to say that Torahcha betoch me'ai is kind of about observing Torah, observing mitzvot properly around food as a precursor to ingesting it. Okay, you'll see what I mean here. This is our midrash. It starts with this pasuk in Mishle, which is generally as written, don't abandon the teachings of your mother. Umatcha, a particular usage, it's like switches the vowel from imecha to umatcha, where that actually means a cluster of produce is one translation of uma. Not particularly common, but it is in a Mishnah. What does that mean then? Don't abandon the teaching that has to do with clusters of produce. We might immediately think of Torah and food and think of laws of kashrut, how we think of that, like, you know, what meat you don't eat and shechita and meat and milk and all of that. But actually, like, in the times of the Mishnah and in the land of Israel, there's all sorts of rules about produce and ma'asarot, right, tithes, like giving away properly the various taxes around food. So we have here this midrash then brings our pasuk from the book of Tehillim, right? David says, "Torahcha betoch me'ai, your teaching is in my innards. I want to do your will." This midrash is struggling with this. What do you mean, the Torah is in the innards? Don't we usually think of Torah being in the heart? We talk about internalizing Torah. Don't we usually use the word heart, right? Doesn't it say, "I will write it on your heart," quoting Yirmiyahu, "Alibam echtavena," right, on their heart? But David says, a curse be upon me if something goes into my innards that I have not tithed. Im yered davar betoch me'ai ad shelo isarti oto. Right, so this is really, v'torahcha betoch me'ai means I have ethically done, to ethically, ritually, depend on how you approach the different ma'asot and who they went to, but we have tithes that go to the class of the Levi'im, and there's also the tithes that go to the poor. Right, the point is, did I make sure everybody else got the food they needed from my produce before I put it in my mouth. And what it means to internalize God's Torah is literally that the food we are eating is adhering to all of the kind of ethical requirements around food. That is one, I think, very kind of concrete interpretation of this pasuk, and may also be interpreting Torah here as Torah, like specific halachic teachings. Okay, any reactions to this way of understanding v'toradcha b'toch me'ai means I am careful about the food I eat? This relates to the question on the spectrum exercise, right? What about all these different laws about labor, etc.? Should you not be able to put food in your mouth if there were bad labor practices around it, or if some people who were supposed to get a portion of that food didn't get it? Should that make it usser to put that food in your mouth, right? Should you approach that food as sort of not kosher, the way you think about that? But this midrash is saying that David sort of had that angle, right? I should not ingest anything unless I know that all of the proper mitzvot were followed, not just in terms of like the substance itself and is it kosher, but where all of the different mouths were given.
During my gap year in Israel, there was a makolet, or a little like store near where I was learning and staying, that didn't take truma and maaser from their produce, which I found out after I had eaten from the store.
In Israel, there's sort of a number of debates about how to approach the laws of giving the various things that are supposed to be given, right? There was a portion that was going to the Kohen, truma, a portion that would go to Levi'im and to the poor, right? Nowadays, the assumption is you cannot necessarily identify who would get these items. And so in Israel, there are places that are sort of strict about removing these portions of food, though they are not then given to people. They're just removed and, right, nobody eats that. And then there are other vendors that are not careful about doing that.
I had this, like, incredibly visceral reaction to when I realized like they didn't take these parts off their produce. And it from an emotional standpoint felt like something fundamentally wrong. Like I had like eaten something wrong.
Okay. There's sort of this like visceral encounter with some wrongdoing in the world. So it sounds like you cannot kind of identify with this impulse that David has. And even though I think it's complicated, right, in that nowadays that's not necessarily connected to others getting the food, but it is connected to sort of the technical halachic requirement. Midrash Tanchuma, in part B here, is a later midrash that is also kind of wrestling with the meaning of this somewhat cryptic pasuk. And here, it associates the phrase V'toradcha b'toch me'ai, right? Your Torah is in my innards, with all the laws in Vayikra that detail what kind of animals we should and should not eat. Zot hachaya asher tochlu. So this is more aligned with like the laws of kashrut. And actually the Midrash doesn't do a lot more than just juxtaposing these two things. V'toradcha b'toch me'ai, your teaching is inside me, inside my guts. That's because there are mitzvot that relate to what kinds of things we should and shouldn't eat. And then this midrash goes on, you are walking to spend our time with it later, to talk about other mitzvot that are like very much in our bodies. It brings the numerical tradition that we have here and elsewhere, that the number of mitzvot corresponds to the number of limbs, and speaks specifically of mitzvot that are like very embedded in our bodies. This, I think, is interesting, meaning over the course of the week, you may or may not end up having discussions and conversations about, like, well, what's the purpose of the laws of kashrut, and are they ethical, or are they, you know, just some total, like, chuk, like an unexplained law? This midrash seems to be suggesting that just the virtue of having mitzvot that tell us what to eat or not eat makes not only, I think we often use the language of, like, oh, since they're mitzvot about what makes something kosher, that brings an element of kedusha to eating. Right? It turns eating into an act that is engaging with kedusha. I think that this midrash is going further by having this teaching in mind, v'toradcha b'toch me'ai, right? This, I think, would suggest that when you are fulfilling mitzvot about food, it is as though God's Torah is being totally internalized. in your body. It's not just like, oh, I am now sort of elevated into a life of Kedusha. It's that the Torah lives inside my body. It sort of breaks a boundary between us and God, right? And this midrash goes on to sort of do that with all sorts of other mitzvot, right? And this is kind of a hotly contested religious question, and certainly a hotly contested religious question in the period of the sort of beginnings of Torah Sheba Al Peh and the development of sort of early Jewish approach vis-a-vis Christianity, especially the question of like, what is the boundary between us and God? How do we encounter God in our world? Right? And this midrash seems to say that through food, right, through mitzvot that have to do with food, we actually kind of internalize. We internalize Torah, we internalize God, or maybe even we kind of internalize God. Like God is sitting in us by virtue of God's Torah and teaching when we have mitzvot about food.
One element of the pasuk that I don't think we focused as much on, but I would like to lift up, is this element of delight, joy, excitement, contrasting the first part of the pasuk to the second part of the pasuk, and how perhaps thinking about embodied Torah and how Torah relates to food in a physical nature can increase our positive and joyful relationship with both Torah and food.
Hmm. Okay, and that's because like there's an element of just like food is like something to enjoy. You enjoy food. And so when you juxtapose those two pieces, it's not like the burden of doing God's will, sort of ol malchut shamayim is a common phrase that we have, the yoke of heaven as some sort of burden potentially. It's like there's an element of joy when we introduce the food into doing God's will. Beautiful, thank you.
So I've just been thinking a lot about the word guts.
Yes.
Is that to me is like very physical. And to me, the phrase spill my guts out comes to mind. That like there's something about like the like inner or gut. There's like a gut feeling. It's like not really a conscious thing. It's more of like a subconscious or like deeper knowledge or emotion. And so when you were saying like internalizing Torah or like some sort of like internalization of God, it might be like almost like internalizing some sort of aspect of spirituality like into your subconscious or like deeper feeling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as opposed to just like being in the world of the brain.
Like brain thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to be sure, right, we know that the heart in the ancient world was thought of as actually like the site for thought. Right now we think of it mostly as emotion. It's not clear that emotion was like distinct from other kinds of sort of thinking or cognitive functions. But actually if you sort of compare, like heart might mean something more like intellect in how we use that word nowadays. And so me'ai is something that's more visceral and like distinct from that intellectual capacity. Any other thoughts? Do you guys think this is crazy? Like eating Torah? Yeah.
No, I think I feel like building on what Paula said about like internalizing, like, you know, in the something that's brought in from your Miata, you know, it says Aliba, like I will write it on your heart. And like also we have Aliba, like on your heart.
Yeah.
And you know, my mom would always say like this thing that her teacher started, which is like the reason it says Aliba Becha and not Yulba Becha is because, you know, you need to let it like sit on your heart and then it can sink in slowly. Mm-hmm. You know, getting it fully in isn't just like an easy thing. And like in the same way, like you eat food, you know, it's easy to like chew it up and swallow it. But like to, you know, the fact that we can like then, you know, derive nutrients from it in our innards is like, that's kind of a miraculous thing. Mm-hmm. So I think like, this is kind of pointing to like, maybe like that there's not really a like dichotomy between like physical and spiritual and like, you know, because maybe like by eating food, you can, you know, let the word sink into your heart by connecting those two, and then like by, you know, understanding, you know, the Torah, understanding the teaching, you can, you know, let the food really nourish you because, you know, you're understanding like, you know, what it took for this food to be made, you know, what the cost of the food being made is.
Okay, amazing. As you were talking, I was thinking of the, like, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink kind of thing, with the, like, things can be on, but to sink in, right, betoch me'ayim is, like, the sinking in element and drawing from it. That is part one, okay? Just introducing this pasuk and trying to understand what it might mean to have the Torah be, like, in our most innermost hearts, and food as sort of a vehicle for that, for really internalizing God's words that are maybe our sort of the way we can most internalize God to some extent. We're going to move to part two, to sources that deal with comparing food and Torah. I kind of want to see where you go with this. We might think of the Torah Chabatoch Me'ay, if we think of, like, food, right, by eating food properly, according to mitzvot, we're internalizing God's word. Right? When we are speaking Torah, it's almost like we are externalizing God's words, right? We're sort of forming, creating, putting God's words out there in the world. I want to look now at these sources that compare the acts of eating and learning Torah by virtue of the fact of saying a blessing before and after. And we could like spend this whole week learning about saying brachot before and after food, and like what are those brachot supposed to do, etc. But mostly what I want to sort of use this as a vehicle for this evening is, like, when you mark a before and an after, it is because something significant happens in between, right? It sort of turns something into an event if you mark the before and after. And in so many ways, like, we're eating all the time. Like, you can't think of every meal as an event with a before and after. It's, like, too much. And yet, halachically, it's sort of framed so that we are invited to think of the act of eating as like, a real event. Something happens. It's like a drama. There's a before and an after. So let's think about this a little bit. We know a sort of very famous pasuk, va'achalta v'savata uveirachta, taken as the source for saying a bracha after we eat. How does this midrash, with that very explicit instruction, how does it go from there to the idea of saying a bracha before food?
My father always told me that the reason not only we say a blessing before we eat, but why it might be even more important to bless before we eat is because, you know, it even says in Torah that you've eaten and now you're satisfied, and it's easy to bless once you've had your fill. And it's equally, if not more important, to be able to be thankful and acknowledge what you're about to have before you have it. So I don't know if that's a direct way we got there, but kind of when to acknowledge and to be thankful in different, like, in the timeline of eating.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so not only after we've kind of experienced some sort of nourishment, satisfaction, etc., but to, like, pause in this moment of craving.
I really love that. And it to me, it strikes almost the opposite of what we, like, how it's framed here, of, like, obviously we should be blessing before, like, because it's so much harder to bless after, or maybe because it's so much less intuitive to bless after, and so it, like, therefore, like, of course you would also bless before. And I like the idea that there's, like, more complexity there, maybe, about, like, what is intuitive or what we would necessarily derive from one versus the other.
Yeah, it's very interesting, right? The relationship between our own intuition and what the Torah has to teach us is very complicated, and different kind of early midrashim, when Torah Shabbat Peh sort of emerges around the time period of the Mishnah, you have kind of different ways of dealing with the difference between our own intuition and what Torah sort of has to come and teach us. And I actually think this midrash, it's like, I almost feel like the two of you said different things in some ways in terms of what our intuition would be. Right? Is the intuition that it's easier to sort of notice some sort of encounter with God after we're feeling that sense of satisfaction and we have been nourished, or we're in that moment of gratitude after the fact? Is that more intuitive? Or I think partly what you've been like, no, it's more intuitive when you're like, oh my gosh, I really need this food. I'm going to say a bracha now in this moment of, like, noticing my need and to some extent, like, my vulnerability and my dependency. Like, I need this food. I'm going to take that as a woman, obviously, to sort of invoke Hashem as part of my interaction with this food. So in some ways, I think this midrash, it's not so obvious where human intuition sits vis-a-vis those two moments. Yes?
Yeah, something we were talking about was like how it's not very clear whether these kind of like hunger, like or the, like whatever, the ta'ava, like the craving, as I guess is in English, like whether or not you're blessing like the craving itself or whether like you're blessing the food itself, because like mm-hmm. you know, the blessings that we traditionally use before we eat food are talking about the food itself that we're about to eat, and not like, and as opposed to the brach, like the birkat mazon that we generally do afterwards, which can like are, is a much broader bracha, like it's a much broader like category of a bracha when it talks about like a lot more than kind of just like the specific food that we ate. Like the bracha beforehand talks about the specific food. Mm-hmm. So if we are trying to like think about like what we are saying the bracha, like what we are blessing God for, can we bless God for that feeling if we're like, if like the verbal expression of our blessing of the feeling is blessing on the food? Does that make sense, that distinction?
I don't know if meaning like, is the bracha about my experience or is the bracha about the food? Is that part of what you're...
Yeah, but meaning, and like, the bracha that we use kind of answers that question. No, like, the bracha is not about your experience. The bracha is about the food. So if we are, meaning, we shouldn't necessarily say that these texts, that like, this text is definitely assuming that the bracha you make beforehand is a, like, nizonot, or is a shahakol, it's talking about the specific food. But if it is, it seems to like be incongruous, because if it was talking about the bracha that you are talking about a specific food, you wouldn't be blessing about your ta'ava, you'd be blessing about the food.
Yeah, unless what the ta'ava does, or the tevon, it's like, because you notice how much you want the food, the bracha frames the food as a gift with a bore.
But is it that specific food, or is it that feeling of needing nourishment?
Is the line kishahu ta'ev, is that about like generally being hungry as opposed to like wanting this thing in particular? Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. Yes.
I mean, this exchange would be realizing that I never paid attention to before, but I totally now in retrospect realize I hate this phrase all the time, which is that when I'm really hungry and I eat something, it tastes more intense that first bite. It's like, this is the most delicious thing I've ever had. By the sixth bite, I'm like, this is just really good, right? But maybe I'm more aware that this is a grain product when I'm hungry, but halfway through it's like I kind of forget it's just food. So I'm not sure that the focus on the food necessarily means it's not about ta'ava.
Right, meaning it's so interesting, right? In restaurant, in the world of like restaurant science or art, I don't know what it is more, the anticipation, the way anticipation affects taste and experience, right, is something that is studied and deployed by people who are trying to earn a buck off of us. But like in some ways that like what having to say a bracha beforehand does in some ways is sort of like make you linger in the anticipation and right, might even make your appreciation of the food more more intense, right? Whether or not you needed like that particular thing or not. Okay, so right, so this is our midrash that introduces that language of kishehu ta'ev, right? That marking that craving. And then I think what I find so interesting, right, then what? How does this map on to Torah, or does exactly? What's our leap from food to Torah? It's like you say a bracha before and after food, appreciation, anticipation, or craving. Now, how do we get there for Torah? Right, what's the link? How do we make this leap? Yeah.
To me, it seems like they're going from like lesser value to greater value. Like in the beginning, like it's of course you're gonna say the blessing before you eat it, because before you eat it there's more like hinging on it, and so there's like more value, whereas it's already like said that it's having to be said afterwards. And like in a similar way, the Torah is like something that is like more valuable. And so it makes sense that if you're already blessing the food, just like if you were already blessing afterwards, that it's more necessary or vital in some way that you would obviously also bless it.
Okay, great. So this seems to be almost like quantitatively related, right? It's like food, we have this language of chaye sha'a. It's some sort of, it gives us some sort of like temporary nourishment or life. While Torah is our chaye olam, or sorry, Olam Haba. That's our language here. Right? Chaye Olam Haba. Right? This is our taste of the world to come. Right? So Torah is our nourishment for Olam Haba. Sort of like the scale just seems to be even more so than nourishment in this world. Okay, right. Thank you. I'm curious if this was resonant for you. Like, did that make sense to you to make that leap? Right, we have sort of a relationship between the two. If you're going to say bracha before and after this kind of temporary nourishment, this nourishment that's sort of only relevant to this world, then of course Torah that is nourishing us for Olam Haba should have that bracha before and after.
Time is different in relation to food and Torah, and the way that maybe even if the leap sort of makes sense in terms of the nourishment, whatever that means, food is something that you could sort of set in time, like either I am putting food into my body at this moment or I'm not. Whereas, like, I think we were sort of talking about this before, the way that Torah Kol B'Toch Me'ai, you sort of want to be embodying Torah all the time, even if you don't literally have a sefer open in front of you. So it sort of feels strange to say a bracha after learning Torah, because does after learning Torah mean?
Yeah. Okay, amazing. Right, we ritualize this. Right? When people come up to the Torah for an aliyah, you say a bracha before and after. But in some ways, like, this is bizarre. It's like food, very concrete. You can really mark a before and after. But like learning Torah, when does it end, right? Let's say you could pin down the moment where an act of learning begins, because it's when you're like exposed to those words or something like that. Like, when does it end? Who knows? Now, I suppose you could say, like, well, that's the digestion process. But to these things, like, learning is sort of our mind and heart integrating words and sort of running with them. Like, it does seem funny to try to mark an end to that. It seems artificial.
I thought it was interesting that, like, they took, you know, food and tried to make a difference between food and Torah, because, like, just because they're both things that we make a bracha before and after, they're not necessarily similar. Whereas, like, Torah, you know, there's, like, it was similar what Josephine was saying about, like, there's no sort of, like, end time to learning Torah. It's also, like, the bracha at the end of food is to symbolize that you are done. But, like, Torah going in beforehand, you know that you're going to say a bracha when you're done with your session of learning, but that bracha doesn't symbolize, like, an end, the same way it does for food.
Mm-hmm.
So it felt like it's not exactly the same right. type of scenario, more just felt like, you know, it's two different cases where we have a bracha before and after the activity that we're doing.
Okay, great. Right, and in some ways I feel like that comment almost leads to more of a question, which is like, why is this midrash so intent on making some kind of comparison between food and Torah, right, sort of moments of ingesting food and moments of experiencing Torah, if, like, it seems like, okay, technically, yes, there's this bracha before and after, but are they actually similar? Like, what is the work that the Midrash does by drawing this comparison? You know, if it's not actually that similar, like, what is it trying to teach us? And in some ways, I think what's interesting about this Midrash, right, it has the language of Kishu Ta'ev, it's like, is it suggesting or kind of trying to bring us into a framework where we will crave Torah and feel that sense of nourishment by Torah in the same way we do for food? It's like we're used to those feelings around food. Is it kind of projecting those feelings onto Torah and sort of cultivating that relationship to Torah so that we should come to crave it as much as we do food?
So we've been talking a lot about, like, the blessings that you have, the before and after Torah when you have an aliyah. But on a report that I was on at a mishmar, we were comparing the blessings on food to Birkat HaTorah. And that, like, the one that you say, like, in the morning, like, before you put on your tallis and tefillin. And we were saying that, like, for food, like, there's Birkat HaMazon after you're done eating, because there is a point where you can say that you are done eating for the moment. But Birkat HaTorah, you say in the morning, and there's no, like, conclusion to it. There's no, like, one that you say when you're done, because there isn't actually a stop point. So I think it's, like, interesting that we're talking about, like, the before and after Aliyot, but there's also that one that, like, there isn't an afterwards portion.
Yeah, Okay, great. Thank you for that comment. I don't know how many of you got it all into the Bavli Sugya here in the Talmud, but actually there you have food is sort of the quintessential paradigm of saying a bracha after, va'achalta v'savata v'rachta, like food we know very clearly say a bracha after, while Torah in the Sugya in the Talmud, Torah becomes the paradigm of saying a bracha before. They sort of have a verse to prove that. They say a bracha before, right? And I think that very much resonates with what you're saying, which is like, yes, you can mark the beginning of learning. That's sort of more obvious and clear, but it's actually maybe harder to mark that.
I was thinking a bit about Eitan's point that there's like not really, there's not a discussion here about any differences in text between the blessings for food versus for Torah. They're just kind of like equating that you say a blessing before and after for both. And also to the point that you made that if the reason why they're so intent on drawing this equivalency between food and Torah is that like they're seeing that people of course crave food as like this physical sensation, they want people to crave Torah the same way. It's like still shocking to me. It's like a dangerous comparison if they think that because even by saying that you should crave Torah the way you crave food, then you're kind of putting more importance on food, which is kind of diminishing Torah in a way that, like, I don't think is their intention, but it kind of comes across that way.
Yeah, meaning because, like, food is sort of the source for learning about this model, and then it's only applied to Torah afterwards. Is that what you mean by it's, like,
yeah, or that, centering food? Yeah, like, part of the reasoning is, like we should say, even for the second Torah, that we should say a blessing before... We can say blessing after Torah because they're saying a blessing after food because Torah and food have this equivalency. I think it's like diminishing Torah by even, it's like shocking to me that they're even applying an equivalency and that they're so like desperate for it.
Okay. So like another kind of comment that's like, why are we sort of, you're like, why are we reducing Torah to be in some discussion about food at all? Like it seems like Torah should be in this much more elevated plane potentially.
I can't stop thinking about like all the similarities between a bracha before Torah, like the actual like material of it, like Bachar Banu, and like the specificity of like us being pulled out of all the people, like singled out and given Torah, and the specificity we see in a bracha before food. You know, it's pulled out of the ground, it's pulled off of a tree, and it's like the specificity of that moment. And the bracha haron, you mentioned earlier, so it's the language chay olam, and then you corrected yourself. I mean, that's
this midrash has olam habat, yeah.
It's not the language here, but it is the language in the bracha haftarah that it's like it's extending its value like through the rest of your life, and in the same way, like you know, like in brachat mazon, there's lots of like generalities, chazanas hakol, and remembering a messianic era, and a rebuilding of shalayim. There's all these like big ideas that we have afterwards. We come into this moment with specificity of like this specific moment, and afterwards that benefits every aspect of our life.
Beautiful. Well, just share briefly. We're not going to do this whole Bavli Sugya inside. It's actually a little bit confusing, even. But one thing that happens in the Talmud, besides what I shared already, which is like food becomes the paradigm of a bracha after, Torah becomes the paradigm for a bracha before, and then we sort of apply them one to the other. And the other piece that's just bolded at the bottom here is kind of drawing a distinction between food and Torah. You can just down the very bottom here in the bold on page 3. Mala mazon shekin nehaneh, umala Torah shekin chaye olam. So this last part of the sugya is sort of drawing distinctions between the two. Food is associated with pleasure, nehene, while Torah is associated with eternal life, right? So while here in the first midrash we looked at, they're like related to each other, it seemed like through scale, sort of Torah is quantitatively better, we have actually two very different understandings of food and Torah and how they're distinct. Which is maybe even a little bit surprising at first blush. Like, I don't know, do you not get any pleasure out of studying Torah? Does it not have any sort of hana'a in it? It's interesting now, maybe it shouldn't, maybe it's not there for hana'a, but I think it's sort of an interesting piece in what happens in this Bavli Sugya, that there's a substantive difference between the two, right? And those end up being tied to how you like, you might... Actually, your intuition about saying a bracha maybe centered on saying a bracha about something that's about pleasure, or maybe centered around saying a bracha for something that's eternal, and then you might not be able to learn from one to the other. I want to make sure we get to this last piece, because this is really meant to kind of crystallize our time here, especially the possibility and danger of shared food. Okay, so I hope like what you've seen now in these sources is kind of the intensity of the encounter of eating food, and by comparing it to Torah, the sort of way in which it could hold religious significance, and that's marked with the bracha before and after. And this last piece is about community in many ways, and the possibilities and danger of sharing food alongside the power of sharing Torah. So these are two mishnayot in Pirkei Avot. You know, they're two different mishnayot. Often people like pull out a mishnah from Pirkei Avot, learn it by itself. And here it's, I think, actually interesting to see that they're juxtaposed, mishnahs 2 and 3 here in the third chapter of Pirkei Avot. Mishnah Bet is about two people sitting together and whether or not they share words of Torah. Right, and the sort of major stakes in that decision. They're considered scorners, moshav letzim, if they don't share Torah, but if they do share Torah, does anything less than make the Shekhinah emerge? So you sort of have that choice anytime you're just with another person, right? Sitting with another person, whether you're going to like make God appear on the scene or kind of do the opposite. And right afterwards, we get the Mishnah about three people who eat together. If they don't say words of Torah, it's as though they ate from zivchei metim, which has some sort of connotation of avodah zarah, most likely, right? It's sort of like the potential for that being like really bad. It's like, not neutral. There's no neutral here. It's like being engaged in idolatry. But this last line in the bold here, shlosha she'achlu ha'shulchan echad ve'amru alav divrei Torah, ki'ilu achlu mishul chanosham makom baruchu. If three people eat together, like we just did, and you say words of Torah, then that shulchan transforms to be nothing other than God's table, bringing a verse from Yechezkel where God is sort of showing Yechezkel the vision of what the future Beit HaMikdash would look like, and uses the word shulchan when describing the mizbeach. So I think like this is kind of like too much to hold every single day, three meals a day. But we maybe like need it in this full force articulation in order to like remind ourselves how powerful the encounter with food can be. And again, here I think to get back to this Torah betoch me'ai, the idea of like we have the potential to not only live lives of kedusha, but actually like internalize God and Torah that can sort of live in us and live between us, right? Through the way we relate to food, we can, in this last source, turn that into something where, like, God is there. We're almost making God manifest by virtue of how we are interacting with food.